This is Beverly Tomasian. I'd like to welcome you to our online course, Women and Diabetes, Special Issues. Thank you so much for joining us. The objectives for this course are as follows. We're going to look at three issues that affect women with diabetes. We'll spend some time talking about the unique attributes of pre-existing diabetes in pregnancy and gestational diabetes, and looking at the diagnostic criteria and management goals for diabetes in pregnancy and gestational diabetes. We'll look at not only the short-term but the long-term complications of fetal exposure to hyperglycemia and talk about ways that we can work to help women keep as healthy as possible before, during, and after pregnancy. Participants completing this program will receive a certificate for one CE unit after completing the post-test and post-program evaluation. We'll start by talking about women and diabetes. Women definitely have special needs regarding their diabetes, and also women become pregnant. Women during pregnancy can experience hyperglycemia, or they can move into pregnancy with pre-existing diabetes. We'll look at the special needs of both situations, and we'll also consider the complications a fetus can have as a result of hyperglycemia during pregnancy. We'll look at the complications that it can occur while the child is in the womb and also after delivery as they move through their lifetime. Women with diabetes have special issues they struggle with. This is an overview slide of some topics I'll be covering in the upcoming slides. One area is sexuality. Women with diabetes often have decreased libido. They may have more vaginal yeast infections and dryness and urinary tract infections, all of which can definitely affect their sexual pleasure and their sex life. Women with diabetes may experience polycystic ovary syndrome. And especially more important is that women who have polycystic ovary syndrome are more likely to have diabetes. And this has to do with excess androgen hormones related to insulin resistance and higher rate of diabetes with women with PCOS. Another issue is heart and blood vessel disease. Women with diabetes experience more heart disease than women who do not have diabetes. And of course, gestational diabetes, a form of hyperglycemia that women can experience during pregnancy. So let's take a look at these more closely. If we think about strategies to help our women with diabetes improve their sex life, here are some things that they can try. One thing is getting their blood sugar to goal, and also their blood pressure. Both of those measures can help improve libido, a sense of pleasure, of sexual pleasure for our patients with diabetes. The other thing is we want to make sure and treat vaginal yeast infections or bacterial infections quickly and effectively, and also treat those urinary tract infections, because UTIs can definitely lead to incontinence and painful urination and really affect sexual pleasure too. Water-based lubricants can help treat vaginal dryness. We also might want to have our women consider hormone replacement therapy. That's a controversial area, so they would have to go to a person who's well-versed in hormone replacement therapy and see if the benefits outweigh the risks for them. The other thing is that women with diabetes may experience hypoglycemia during intimacy. So if our patients are on insulin or sulfonylurea and they're having intercourse, we want to make sure they check their blood sugar beforehand, and if the blood sugar is too low, they may need a snack. Or if over time they notice during intimacy they have hypoglycemia, they might want to plan ahead. For some of our patients, this is for women and also for men, they may not be as interested in sexual intimacy, but maybe they just want to go more toward romance and touching and experiencing their partner in that way. The other thing I always encourage my patients to do is talk to their partner, be honest. And many times couples may benefit from couple counseling. So this is an opportunity for people to kind of look at their sex life, see what level of importance it is for them. And if they feel like they're really lacking and that's an area they want to address, we can provide them resources and really acknowledge that this is an important issue for them. Another suggestion we could use is encouraging women to have scents that arouse around the house when they're planning for intimacy. And I have a list here, and this is from a book by the American Diabetes Association called Diabetes and Your Sex Life. And you can see or hear some really interesting scents that arouse for women. Pumpkin pie, lavender, baby powder, chocolate, and for men. So I think it's kind of interesting. There's some overlapping scents that arouse, and there's some very unique scents that arouse. I like this donut on the men and the cinnamon buns. So these are just some different strategies to talk about improving your sex life, and maybe these might arouse women, and along with improved blood sugar control, can improve their sex life. Let's talk a little bit about polycystic ovary syndrome. PCOS, as it's often called, is a reproductive disorder where there's too much androgen and ovulatory dysfunction. So the woman isn't ovulating as frequently as normally. Maybe they ovulate 2 to 3 times a year. So they're trying to get pregnant. They can't get pregnant because of this ovulation problem. And they may just have too much of the testosterone or male hormones. And this is associated with less ovulation, but also the whole metabolic syndrome. About 40% of patients with polycystic ovary syndrome are hyperglycemic. So they have higher than normal levels of blood sugar because of this insulin resistance, and about 10% of them actually do have diabetes. What are some clinical findings that we might see for women with PCOS? Well, I went to a conference at the ADA, and the speaker was talking about PCOS, and she said, PCOS is a 5 o'clock shadow of metabolic syndrome. So that's, she was really talking about the relationship between insulin resistance and the manifestation of PCOS, which is oftentimes women have facial hair. So they, because of the excess testosterone, so they have infertility, irregular menses, acne, obesity, dyslipidemia. And the AN stands for acanthosis nigricans. So they might have darkening of their skin around their neck, around their skin folds, areas that bend or rub together. These are very kind of common clustering of clinical manifestations. How do we treat PCOS? Very interesting. We treat it very similar to diabetes because we know type 2 diabetes is insulin resistance. PCOS is insulin resistance. And the major thing we're going to do is weight loss, exercise, and the medications that are used to treat PCOS, the thiazolidinediones like Actos or metformin, decrease insulin resistance, and then the woman can start ovulating. So if they become pregnant and they're on these medications, we're going to have to think about, do we need to change those over? Many times now, the providers will leave them on metformin if their blood sugars were elevated prior and they get pregnant, they may leave them on metformin because even though it's off-label, the FDA does not approve metformin for use during pregnancy, many providers are choosing to do that. However, if you're going to take the CDE exam, currently the ADA does not endorse metformin as a choice to be used for pregnancy. So just to clarify that, but it is being used in that off-label way. So polycystic ovary syndrome, insulin resistance, often associated with lack of ovulation. We treat it by decreasing insulin resistance. The woman starts ovulating again, and she may become pregnant. And then we'll have to evaluate her blood sugars during pregnancy. We certainly know she has PCOS going into pregnancy. She's more likely to have gestational diabetes. So we're going to keep a close eye on this woman because we know she has that insulin resistance manifestation. What about women, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease? Well, this is a pretty shocking statistic. 5 times the rate of heart disease than women without diabetes. So our women with diabetes have a high risk of cardiovascular events, heart attack, and stroke. And you can see that the heart disease mortality rate in women is on the rise. Now, we're trying to figure out why do women have a higher post myocardial infarction mortality rate than men with diabetes. We're not really sure, but we're thinking that women have a greater tendency toward higher blood pressures, blood glucose, they're more likely to be dyslipidemic, obese, more depression, and they make less money. They have lower socioeconomic status. And many times women are misdiagnosed. They come into the emergency room or their doctor, they're complaining of chest pain. Especially if you have diabetes, you may not be presenting with the usual type of chest pain, the crushing pain. It may just be you don't feel quite right, or you're sweaty, or you have some back pain. So many times it's detected later. So we're certainly thinking about women's special needs around heart disease to see, can we really intervene and help women prevent getting myocardial infarctions, or at the very least be recognized early on so they receive the appropriate treatment. Women deserve special care. Certainly, reaching out to women has the potential to slow the diabetes epidemic. We'll be taking a look at this more closely, and we'll be focusing on prenatal health, perinatal health during the pregnancy, and also postnatal health. And I'm going to look at this from a perspective of blood sugar dynamics during these stages, but I also want to take a look at it from a public health perspective and what we can do as diabetes educators in our community, family, our social, and our work settings to help inform women to know about all the benefits of blood sugar control pre, during, and post-delivery. And I think as women become more informed, this is a very highly motivated time, pregnancy, we can make some definite changes in the levels of diabetes in our communities. One of the foremost leaders in the field of diabetes and pregnancy is Dr. Lois Jovanovic. And she has a very personal story associated with her journey in diabetes, and that is her grandmother was 8 years old when she developed diabetes in 1922 and was one of the first children to receive insulin from Banting and Best. They were in Winnipeg at the time. She gave birth to Dr. Jovanovic's dad, and he died, and then she died shortly afterward, very unfortunately. But both Dr. Jovanovic's father and, of course, Dr. Jovanovic herself developed type 1 diabetes. And it's just really an amazing story. This is actually a letter written to Dr. Banting, the inventor of insulin, discoverer of insulin, from Dr. Jovanovic's grandmother. And you can see that in the early days, women who had diabetes pre-existing before they got pregnant oftentimes had very difficult pregnancies. Many times the mother didn't live or the child didn't live. But we've really improved our care of diabetes and pregnancy, thanks in a great part to the work of Dr. Jovanovic and the other team of experts who have come together and set new standards for diabetes care during pregnancy, and I'll be talking about those. It's very exciting work. But I just would like to recognize all the work Dr. Jovanovic has done to improve care during pregnancy and improve outcomes for mother and fetus. I'd like to take a look at gestational diabetes from a public health perspective. Certainly, we know that there's been a tremendous increase in the prevalence of gestational diabetes. Gestational diabetes is diabetes diagnosed during pregnancy, usually around 24 to 28 weeks. And we've seen in the past 20 years, the rate has gone up almost double in certain ethnic groups. And it's the same ethnic groups who are at risk for diabetes in general, are African Americans, Hispanic, Native American, Asian American populations. We're seeing their rates rise tremendously in those groups. And what we know is that as women experience more gestational diabetes, then they are more likely to have gestational diabetes again in their future pregnancies, and they're more likely to have diabetes in the future. Their offspring are at also greater risk for insulin resistance, pre-diabetes, and diabetes during their lifetime. So the degree of gestational diabetes in the population gives us a perspective on the future rate of diabetes in the population. So if we see the rate rising in women, we know there's going to be a general increase in the number of people experiencing diabetes in our community. This slide looks at the future risk of getting diabetes if a woman experienced gestational diabetes during her pregnancy. You can see immediately after birth, about 5 to 10% have diabetes. That is, the gestational diabetes doesn't depart, it's still with them. What about 6 to 12 weeks later? Well, 6 to 12 weeks later, about 10% are actually diagnosed with diabetes, and 20% have prediabetes, so their blood sugar numbers are on the rise. 36 months later, about 30% have metabolic syndrome. When we say metabolic syndrome, that's just a manifestation of insulin resistance, and they may be experiencing some degree of hyperglycemia. 5 years later, about 50% of women who had gestational diabetes will have type 2. And if we keep looking down the line, that number gradually increases over time. So the younger you were when you had gestational diabetes, the more pregnancies you had with gestational diabetes, and looking at other risk factors that can increase or decrease your risk of getting type 2 diabetes later. But certainly we know that women who experience gestational diabetes, it tells us their pancreas may not be working well enough to help maintain euglycemia during their lifetime. Gestational diabetes is a stress time. So if a woman experiences hyperglycemia during pregnancy, we know that they're at risk for future gestational diabetes and also future diabetes. I'd like to talk about pre-pregnancy weight as a major indicator of risk of getting gestational diabetes. Overweight and obesity accounts for about 46% of gestational diabetes cases, and this was an article done by Shin Kim, 2009. 70% of women with GDM have a BMI of 25 or greater. So we already have a predictive factor. The weight a woman goes into pregnancy at increases or decreases her risk of experiencing gestational diabetes. And you can look at this BMI prior to pregnancy. You can see for those very low BMI women, the risk is very low of getting gestational diabetes. And as we go up to the BMIs of 25 or greater, we see definitely a leap up. And you can see BMI of 35 or greater, 11.5% risk of gestational diabetes. So I think this just tells us one important message for our women. And this is as they're going, you know, through their adolescence, to help our girls maintain a BMI less than 25. Because as they move into menstruation and when they are able to become pregnant, we really want to help our women to have that BMI less than 25 to decrease the risk of getting gestational diabetes. So I think starting from a young age, encouraging exercise, healthy eating, you know, keeping at a healthy weight is going to be really important so we can decrease the overall risk of gestational diabetes in our populations. If we keep looking at perinatal behavior, what else can influence increase or decrease risk of gestational diabetes? Well, it turns out weight gain really matters. And we certainly know we have all these different weight tables, how much weight women should gain during pregnancy. And the heavier you are, the less you need to gain. But there seems to be this cutoff point. If a woman gains more than 40 pounds during pregnancy, the risk of diabetes, getting gestational diabetes, increases. And as I've listed here, if they're obese, they don't need to gain weight during pregnancy. Certainly, we know there's a tremendous risk of getting diabetes after gestational diabetes. And the other thing I've mentioned is that the woman's child is at risk for insulin resistance and future diabetes. The other thing I do want to mention is kind of been out in the literature now for about, I would say, 7 years, that babies who are small for gestational age, which is about 5.8 pounds or less, are more at risk for insulin resistance and obesity as they get older. So if they're in utero and not getting enough calories or energy needs, they develop kind of a survival mechanism of insulin resistance, and that helps them live and maintain their weight. And then as they grow into adulthood, that insulin resistance stays and they're at higher risk for diabetes in the future. The other thing that is just has happened in the past few years, if you look at which children to screen for diabetes, like who are the high-risk children, gestational diabetes is now a risk factor. If that child's mother had GDM, that child is at risk for diabetes. So the American Diabetes Association has also recognized GDM as a risk for that child getting future diabetes. Let's look more closely now at gestational diabetes. As you can see, it affects up to 18% of all pregnancies. This number is related to, as we've mentioned before, the risk factors for gestational diabetes. So we certainly know certain ethnic groups are at higher risk, and also women with previous gestational diabetes and, you know, moving into pregnancy overweight are more likely to get it also. But how do we define gestational diabetes? This is really important. It's any degree of glucose intolerance with the onset or first recognized during pregnancy. And this is usually discovered during that 24 to 28 week period when we do the oral glucose tolerance test, and may or may not persist after pregnancy. So a woman may have GDM and it may leave when she's delivered, or it may stay, or she may get she might get diabetes in the future. Those at highest risk of type 2 diabetes postpartum are those that are diagnosed early, have higher blood sugar levels, and are obese. I've listed here some risk factors for gestational diabetes. We've talked about some of these. Some other factors include age. The older we are, the more likely we are to have high blood sugar during pregnancy. We've talked about weight. If the woman has also had a large for gestational age infant in the past, the more children, the higher your risk, the history of glucose intolerance. And of course, if you have that genetic history of diabetes in your family, and as we've mentioned before, a history of polycystic ovary syndrome. So as we're working with women moving into childbearing, these are certain risk factors we're going to look out for to monitor their blood sugars closely during pregnancy. As far as screening for gestational diabetes, we've kind of changed the way we've looked at this, and that is any woman at risk for diabetes should be screened for gestational diabetes when she's first found out to be pregnant. And this is really new wording set forth by the American Diabetes Association. Here's the reason why. And that is, a lot of women, when they enter pregnancy, had diabetes and it was undiagnosed. So we know that any fetal exposure to hyperglycemia early on can be very detrimental. So now what we're saying is a little bit different than what we said 10 years ago. And that is, if any woman has a risk factor for diabetes, let's screen them right away at pregnancy. And those risk factors are the same ones set forth for people with at risk for type 2, that is BMI 25 or greater, with any additional risk factors. And that was a different ethnic group, sedentary lifestyle, hypertension, previous big baby, history of prediabetes, all of those different risk factors. So now what we're going to say is, if you get pregnant and you have one of those risk factors, we're going to check your blood sugars. And if it's higher than that normal threshold, we're going to treat it starting from pregnancy. So this is very important. And if that woman does have hyperglycemia at that first visit, it is not called gestational diabetes. It is considered pre-existing diabetes or type 2 diabetes, and it's considered hyperglycemia during pregnancy, and it will need to be treated right away. But if we test her blood sugar initially at that time and it's normal, then we will go ahead and retest at 24 to 28 weeks. So I'll be going over more of this, but I think this is such an important philosophical change in the way that we're looking at women entering pregnancy, that we know we don't want any fetus exposed to any degree of hyperglycemia. So we're going to be much more aggressive in screening women upon at the first moment they know that they're pregnant. So this slide is really just explaining a little bit more what I've said previously, and that is, now we're thinking about detection of hyperglycemia early in pregnancy. We want to catch it as early as possible. So what it says here is that women found to have diabetes at their initial prenatal visit receive a diagnosis of overt diabetes, not gestational, and they're treated as having diabetes in pregnancy. This is really important because you'll see as we go through this program that women who have diabetes in pregnancy have different glucose goals than women with gestational diabetes. So diabetes in pregnancy is when you're first found out you're pregnant, you're hyperglycemic. Gestational diabetes is your blood sugars are normal earlier in pregnancy, but they go higher at that 24 to 28 week window. And so this, again, is kind of a different way of looking at it, but it's based on all the work by Dr. Jovanovic and colleagues and the HAPO study, which really changed the diagnostic criteria for diabetes and also made us appreciate more that we don't want to expose that fetus to any hyperglycemia. So continuing this thought, if the blood glucose is normal at initial screening during pregnancy, then as I've mentioned, we do that oral glucose tolerance test at 24 to 28 weeks. So if that initial blood sugar test is normal range, we'll wait till that 24 to 28 week period. And now we're just standardizing it. We're doing 75 gram oral glucose tolerance test. It's not 50 or 100, it's 75. So this is really important to keep in mind too. Starting in 2014, there are now two options to test for gestational diabetes. There is the one-step approach, which looks at a 75-gram oral glucose tolerance test. This oral glucose tolerance test is administered at 24 to 28 weeks of pregnancy. The OGTT is done in the morning after an overnight fast of 8 hours or greater. This is an important point to keep in mind. A woman must be fasting as she enters this OGTT. The diagnosis of gestational diabetes is made if any of the following values are met or exceeded. So if the fasting blood glucose is 92 or greater, 1 hour is 180 or greater, or the 2 hour is 153 or greater, then the woman has now been diagnosed with gestational diabetes. And this is based on the hyperglycemia and adverse pregnancy outcome study, which looked to see where does fetal harm take place when looking at exposure to glucose. And these were the numbers that were determined. Another option to diagnose gestational diabetes is a National Institutes for Health, or NIH, two-step. It's a little bit different than the previous option. The first step is a 50-gram oral glucose tolerance test. And important to note, this is non-fasting, so a woman could eat a meal, come in, and take this 50-gram oral glucose tolerance test. And then we look at her 1 hour post-glucose level. If the blood glucose is 140 or greater at 1 hour, we go to step two. But if you follow the asterisk down to underneath the box, you will see that the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists actually does recommend a lower threshold of 135 in high-risk ethnic minorities with a higher prevalence of GDM. Some experts also recommend that the cutoff is 130. So 140 is a basic number, but we're going to look at the individual and see their risk, and we might actually be more suspect at a blood glucose of 130 to 135. If that blood glucose meets the threshold, we do go to step two. Now, step two is 100-gram oral glucose tolerance, and this is a fasting procedure. The diagnosis of gestational diabetes is met if two or more values are met or exceeded. So now we have two different targets here, or diagnostic threshold levels, the Carpenter and Coustan or the NDDG. So depending on where you work or what your provider or your organization is comfortable with, they will use either this criteria, the Carpenter-Coustan, or the NDDG criteria. For the exam, if you're taking it, I would be familiar with the one step and the two step, and you might want to be familiar with a different criteria listed here. So this is just happened in 2014, and maybe in the future we'll see a changing of this criteria again, but for now this is what we are working with, and this is our diagnostic criteria for gestational diabetes. So that was gestational diabetes. Let's now talk about diabetes in pregnancy. It's also referred to as pre-existing diabetes. And I want to say that I think there's going to be a big movement to clarify our language around this, because we really don't have a clear description of these two different types of diabetes during pregnancy that are universally agreed upon. So I think we're kind of struggling through this, but just so you know, Gestational diabetes, 24 to 28 weeks, it's usually diagnosed. Diabetes in pregnancy means that woman comes in with pre-existing diabetes. She already knew she had diabetes before she walked in the door. Or when we first test her blood sugar, when she's pregnant, she sees that her blood sugars are elevated and they meet the criteria for diabetes. So this woman may actually have had diabetes and it wasn't diagnosed. So we're catching it now, early in pregnancy. So I've said this, a woman with pre-existing type 1 or type 2 becomes pregnant, or a woman who just walks through the door, doesn't know she has diabetes, we test her, wow, she's newly pregnant and diabetes, two things at once become apparent to her. As you know, two-thirds of all pregnancies with diabetes aren't planned. So we're really trying to work with women who have diabetes to say, let's really think about contraception. Let's be ready for pregnancy because we know there's a higher risk of malformation if the fetus is exposed to hyperglycemia during the first 6 to 8 weeks. It's a very critical growth time, especially for brain and nerve development and organ development. So we don't want that fetus to be exposed to any degree of hyperglycemia in those first critical weeks. The other thing we definitely know is any A1C greater than 1% above normal range increases the risk of congenital malformations. So we want to keep that A1C less than 7% before that woman gets pregnant. Any glucose deviation above that increases the risk of complication. So as I've mentioned, we really want to work with our women with diabetes to make sure they're ready for pregnancy, their A1Cs are down, we make sure that they're in overall good health, and they're ready to go through this almost 10-month gestation period of growing this child and keeping it healthy. If a fetus is exposed to hyperglycemia in that first trimester, we know there's increased risk of miscarriage. Really fortunately, as we've improved our control of glucose during pregnancy, you can see the fetal mortality rates have dropped dramatically since 1960. However, if the fetus is exposed to hyperglycemia in that first trimester, you can see the possible congenital malformations that can occur. A spina bifida, an encephaly, heart defects, renal defects, organ position reversal. So it's that early time of organogenesis that is at risk, and also for the nerve development. So this is a very critical time for fetal growth and development, and we want to minimize the risk. So for preconception counseling and care with those with pre-existing diabetes, as I've mentioned before, we're going to make sure that we get that A1C down below 7%. Until we do that, we're going to use contraception. And once we get the A1C to goal and the woman feels like she's ready, then they can go ahead and pursue pregnancy. We're going to look at the mother's health status, especially with a close eye to micro and macrovascular disease. We want to treat that before she gets pregnant. We also want to really focus on diabetes self-management education. Carb counting is really important during pregnancy. A lot of women can't tolerate a lot of carbohydrates in the morning. They're going to need to spread those carbs throughout the day, and they're going to have to do some many times insulin matching to their carbohydrates. So we're going to provide a real good review of what are carbohydrates and kind of how do we spread them out through the day during pregnancy. We're also going to focus on blood glucose monitoring. For women, during pregnancy, they may have to check their blood sugars a lot more frequently than they were used to, and we're going to ask them to maintain really tight control. It's going to be a lot of work on their part, but during pregnancy, women are very motivated to take care of that little fetus and baby. We're going to talk about exercise, safe exercise, and insulin if it's going to be needed. And definitely, we're going to look at their current medication profile and make sure that none of the medications that they're on are contraindicated during pregnancy. We're going to have to stop the statins, ACE inhibitors, and ARBs. And you can imagine for many of our women with pre-existing diabetes, many of them have vascular disease and insulin resistance, and maybe they're on these meds. So these are definitely not advised during pregnancy. We're going to have to evaluate that and make sure they stop them before they become pregnant. Another reason that women with diabetes really need to be ready for pregnancy. The other thing is metformin and acarbose are risk B category for pregnancy. And this is from the American Diabetes Association. So that means that they may be safe during pregnancy. We don't have good data to support that because we don't test many medications during pregnancy. But some of the work from Dr. Jovanovic and colleagues has indicated that these medications seem quite safe during pregnancy. So the ADA does not say, yes, take them, but they do say they are risk category B, which means they might be acceptable as a treatment for diabetes and pregnancy, diabetes during pregnancy. I've been talking a lot about hyperglycemia and fetal risk, and I'd like to explore that a little bit more. If we think about gestational diabetes, during the second to third trimester, there is an increase in insulin resistance. And associated with that insulin resistance in some women, not all women. So this is interesting because it tells us if they get hyperglycemia during pregnancy, as I've mentioned before, that means their pancreas probably is at risk for diabetes and future diabetes. So we know that their pancreas can't respond to the stress of pregnancy to produce enough insulin, and they probably have insulin resistance. So this leads to that hyperglycemia. So the second or third trimester, we're more insulin resistant, but not all women get hyperglycemic during that second or third trimester, just those at risk. So what happens now as they have this hyperglycemia, the mother is has more glucose in her bloodstream, and this extra glucose in the blood is passed on to the fetus through the placenta. But the thing is, maternal insulin cannot cross the placenta. So while glucose is easily diffused through the placenta to the fetus, the insulin is not. So what happens is that since the baby or the fetus is being exposed to this hyperglycemic environment, the fetus starts making more insulin from its own pancreas. So it has to generate extra insulin to help manage this extra glucose. Now, as you know, insulin is a growth hormone. And so insulin does stimulate the growth of the fetus. So the fetus, that's where that macrosomia or the big babies come in. But also it helps the baby store extra fat. And a lot of this fat is visceral adiposity. So at this very, at the very early stages of life, this baby from its exposure to glucose and it's making extra insulin, it's going to have more visceral adiposity, and actually it's going to have extra fat throughout its body in addition to being a larger size. So this is where the issues come in with the difficult deliveries, because these babies are so much larger than a child who is not exposed to extra glucose. What are some of the risks associated with second and third trimester hyperglycemia? Well, as we've discussed, macrosomia is one of our biggest risk factors, as far as if this child is large, a vaginal delivery may be very difficult. There may be a lot more birth trauma. The delivery may be very difficult. There may be a shoulder dystocia or shoulder dislocation, fractures of the clavicle. And certainly the larger the baby, that mother is at risk for needing a C-section. So this is certainly an issue we need to consider. The other thing is stillbirth. Babies exposed to hyperglycemia during pregnancy are at higher risk for that. And this is a very heartbreaking situation that we really want to avoid at all costs. Mothers may also experience polyhydramnios, where there's so much excess amniotic fluid, and that can be very an issue. And more risk for preeclampsia, hypertension, edema, and proteinuria. Also, if a fetus is exposed to excess glucose while they're in the womb, as they are delivered, they're not getting that infusion of glucose, but their pancreas is still pumping out a lot of insulin, they can get severe neonatal hypoglycemia. So many times for mothers with gestational diabetes, we'll keep a very close eye on that baby's blood sugar and really encourage immediate breastfeeding to keep that blood sugar above 40. Another issue to consider when we think about the consequences of gestational diabetes is the long-term effects on the fetus as they are born and move into childhood and then on to adulthood. How does that exposure to hyperglycemia and the uterine environment affect them throughout their lifetime. And I've listed some of those issues that we might see here. And I think this is helpful as we talk to our mothers who are entering pregnancy or women who are pregnant to say, just so you know, these are some of the long-term consequences, and that might actually give them even more motivation to keep their blood glucose levels within goal range during the pregnancy. It's not easy. So I think the more we let them know their work is worth it, the more motivation and the more care they can take, not only of this pregnancy, but future pregnancies also. So you can see if that fetus is exposed to excess glucose in the uterus, that child is going to make more insulin, and this can lead to these metabolic issues later in life: obesity, visceral adiposity, hyperinsulinemia, insulin resistance, and that is all associated with vascular disease and metabolic syndrome. So I think this is a very important issue to discuss and consider also when working with our women who are entering childbearing years or who have hyperglycemia in pregnancy. All right, now it's your turn. I'd like to go through these following scenarios and have you think about, is this gestational diabetes or pre-existing diabetes? What you can do is, as I talk about the different situations, after I read it through, you can put me on pause and then come back and listen to the correct answer. The first one, we have a type 1 who just found out she is pregnant. Is that gestational diabetes or pre-existing? You're right. It is pre-existing diabetes. This is pretty straightforward. This woman, as she moves into pregnancy, has already been diagnosed with type 1. So she has pre-existing diabetes. Let's go on to the next one. We have a 29-year-old. Her fasting blood glucose is 89 at 8 weeks. At 25 weeks, when we do the 75 oral glucose tolerance test, her fasting blood sugar is 103. And her 2-hour is 152. Is that gestational diabetes or pre-existing diabetes? All right, let's go over this one. So she came into the clinic and they found out she was pregnant. And for whatever reason, maybe she has risk factors of diabetes, they decided to do a fasting blood glucose on her. Well, as it turns out, her fasting blood glucose is normal at 89. We use the same criteria. If it had have been 126 or greater, that would have equaled diabetes. And if the fasting blood sugar would have been 100 to 125, that would have been pre-diabetes. And she did not reach that threshold. Let's take a look at her oral glucose tolerance test. Her fasting blood glucose was 103 and her 2-hour is 152. As you remember, with the new criteria to diagnose gestational diabetes, one of the numbers has to be higher than the criteria set forth. And her fasting blood glucose levels should be less than or equal to 92. And her fasting blood glucose is 103. So we definitely know that reaches the criteria for gestational diabetes. Her 2-hour, the goal for 2-hour is less than or equal to 153. She's 152. So that, even though that is under the criteria threshold, because we have one that's elevated, we know she reaches the criteria for gestational diabetes. So she is gestational. Let's go to our next one. Type 2 on metformin. She's pregnant for the first time. Is this pre-existing diabetes or gestational? Right. This woman has pre-existing diabetes because as she moves into pregnancy, she's already on metformin and she's been diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. So that is considered pre-existing, and we're going to have to really work with her to help manage blood glucose levels during her entire pregnancy. How about this situation? Family history of diabetes. Her fasting blood glucose is 129 at 7 weeks. Is that GDM or pre-existing? So this woman came into the clinic and they did a history of her, history and physical. And she said, yeah, my family members have diabetes. So they decided, let's screen this woman. And certainly they found out when they did their fasting blood glucose, it was 129 when she was only 7 weeks pregnant. So that means she's walking into pregnancy with diabetes. So she is considered having pre-existing diabetes. So I hope that was a helpful review for you. Let's go on and talk about management goals during pregnancy with hyperglycemia. I think it's interesting to take note of normal blood glucose levels during pregnancy, because as we move on to what are the glucose goals during pregnancy, you can see where those goals were in part derived. We're trying to get back to what normal levels would be during pregnancy, and also where we know that fetal harm can occur due to the higher levels of blood glucose. So we're taking both of those into consideration. But normally during pregnancy, the mean fasting blood glucose is 61 to 75. That's, you know, surprisingly low. And that number, you know, might fluctuate a little bit during pregnancy as a hormone shift, but that's the general range. If we look at the peak postprandial blood glucose, it really exceeds 126 milligrams per deciliter. So during pregnancy, a lot of the energy that we consume is shunted off to the baby. Maximal postprandial excursions of blood glucose normally happen 60 to 90 minutes after the start of meal during pregnancy. So that's why you'll see we measure blood glucose levels in pregnancy usually within about an hour after the start of the meal. Let's talk about gestational diabetes blood glucose goals. These are women who their diabetes is discovered around the 24 week of pregnancy. What are they working toward as far as blood glucose goals? Well, we want to get their preprandial blood sugars less or equal to 95. We want to get that 1 hour after meal blood sugar less than or equal to 140, and 2 hours after a meal less than or equal to 120. So as we're working with our patients with gestational diabetes, this is certainly the direction we're going to point them toward. And they're going to achieve this through really a strong emphasis is placed on carbohydrate counting, spreading carbs throughout the day. And also we're going to talk about activity. And many of our women with gestational diabetes will need medications to help bring that blood glucose to goal range. And this is the latest glucose goals set forth by the American Diabetes Association. If you're planning on taking the exam to become a certified diabetes educator, these are definitely excellent goals to keep in mind for the exam. The blood glucose goals for women with pre-existing type 1 or type 2 are a little different than gestational diabetes. As you can see, the pre-meal, bedtime, and overnight blood sugar goals are 60 to 99. So we really want to keep that blood sugar less than 100 and greater than 60 or greater. The peak post-meal blood glucose levels, and that's at 60 to 90 minutes after a meal, 100 to 129. And the A1C less than 6%. We're going to keep a very close eye on these blood glucose numbers and the A1C. And as you can imagine, it's going to take an interdisciplinary team effort to reach these goals, because this is really excellent glucose control during pregnancy. And if the woman is experiencing any hypoglycemia to an excessive degree, we may have to adjust these goals up a little bit to prevent that. Of course, we want to keep the mother and the fetus safe. That's the number one goal. And try and keep blood glucose levels to these target ranges. In addition to monitoring blood glucose during pregnancy, we certainly want to keep blood pressure and lipids in mind. You can see that the blood pressure goal during pregnancy for systolic 110 to 129 and diastolic 65 to 79. If the woman is not achieving these blood pressure goals, we're going to have to be very cautious in how we manage her medications, because we definitely know that ACE inhibitors and the ARBs, or angiotensin renin blockers, are contraindicated during pregnancy. So we're going to have to use alternate pharmacological interventions to help her reach her blood pressure target. In addition, many women entering pregnancy with diabetes may be on the statin medications. These are also contraindicated during pregnancy. So again, this just reminds us that any woman with diabetes on these medications who is considering becoming pregnant, we definitely need to be aware of that, plan for the pregnancy, stop these medications before she comes pregnant, and use alternate medications to help keep blood pressure and lipids to where they need to be. In addition, postnatal health, maternal behavior is so important also for the health, of course, of the baby and the health of the mother. We definitely know that breastfeeding is the best option. Some women can't breastfeed for whatever reason, and of course, you know, that's understandable. But if we can really promote breastfeeding to those women who are able, it can really make a big difference in weight management for the child's lifetime. Breastfed infants are less likely to be overweight, not only in the early years, but as they move into adulthood. And it reduces the risk of type 1 and type 2 diabetes in infants who are breastfed. And look at this, breastfeeding helps mom too. It lowers her risk of diabetes by 50% or greater. Plus, for mom, it also decreases hypertension, improves lipid profile, and of course, helps lose that pregnancy weight. So whatever we can do to help set up environments to promote breastfeeding, to talk to mom that any degree of breastfeeding is better than none. So whatever you can do will be very beneficial, not only for your child, but also for your health too. After delivery, we want to keep connected to our women with gestational diabetes because we know they are at greater risk for future hyperglycemia. The American Diabetes Association recommends screening at 6 to 12 weeks postpartum using the non-pregnant oral glucose tolerance test criteria. So we're not going to use an A1C because that might not reflect accurately her blood sugars for the past 3 months, and some of those months would be during her pregnancy when she was treated for hyperglycemia. So the ADA recommends the OGTT criteria. We're going to repeat it on a regular basis, or if she has any signs of hyperglycemia, we'll bring her in for testing. We're going to definitely encourage a healthy lifestyle on an ongoing basis, including weight control, exercise, making sure that we keep her cholesterol and blood pressure within that target range, and also make sure she's connected with her healthcare team. After delivery, many women are just overwhelmed with the task of taking care of that new child, and sometimes their own health might get lost in the mix. We want to make sure she remains connected, and certainly we want to provide preconception counseling so that before she enters her next pregnancy, she's in the best health possible, and we make sure that we really help promote, you know, a healthy, sound pregnancy. And if at all possible, we're going to work with that woman to prevent hyperglycemia for any subsequent pregnancies. Our women with pre-existing diabetes have special needs postpartum. Certainly, now that she's no longer pregnant, we're going to need to make adjustments in the meal plan, medications, insulin, and really get her goals and her new needs given her family and other issues that might be coming up. We're also going to have to take a look at breastfeeding and blood glucose balance. When we breastfeed, 300 calories a day or more are lost to making the energy required to make the breast milk. So we're going to have to adjust medication therapy to prevent hypoglycemia and certainly take a real close look at carbohydrate intake and caloric intake throughout the day. Another thing we're going to start early on is birth control planning, because preconception counseling starts after delivery. We know that women can become pregnant very quickly after delivering, and we want to make sure that before the woman enters pregnancy, blood glucose are at goals and she's emotionally and socially ready for her next pregnancy. The other thing that's very important is ongoing connection with the healthcare team for long-term follow-up and ongoing care. And to be aware that postpartum depression can be an issue for women with diabetes, and we need to look for that, be aware of it, and provide resources if that woman is struggling with depression. In summary, reaching out to women and providing them with necessary tools and resources pre-pregnancy, during pregnancy, and post-pregnancy is critical, and it can certainly make a tremendous impact in the health of our country. We want to work hard to help prevent gestational diabetes by keeping our women as they enter into childbearing years at a healthy weight and promoting healthy eating and activity. And we want to make sure that women have access to the resources they need as far as education, screening, and tools to help them live the most healthiest life possible. Thank you so much. Some resources that you might be interested in taking a look at are the ADA Standards of Care, which outlines the updated criteria for diagnosing gestational diabetes. You can just click on any of these links. If you would like some more information about diabetes and pregnancy and gestational diabetes, I encourage you to take a look at the Art and Science book. It's full of information on not only diabetes and pregnancy, but many other topics that is a resource that you could use for the rest of your diabetes career. In 2014, I wrote a newsletter dedicated to women and diabetes. And in that newsletter, there's a lot of great information, links, resources, and a nice summation of prevention of gestational diabetes and how women can make a difference in slowing down this epidemic of diabetes. If you want to take a look at the HAPO study, this is the link for that. And then an excellent review article on diagnosis and treatment of hyperglycemia in pregnancy is here also for your review. We have other free webinars that expand information on different topics that are relevant to the time. So to click on this link, you can sign up for our free webinars at our diabetes education website. We thank you so much for joining our web clinic. Just some wrap-up notes, you have 1 year to complete this program and take the post-test to receive your CE credit from time of purchase. However, if you would like an extension, you need more time, please just contact us. We'd be happy to help out. To receive your CE certificate, just complete the post-test and the program survey. Your certificate now is ready to print out, and there will be a copy of it on your online course resource page for future reference. Have any questions? We'd love to hear from you. You can contact us, bev@diabetesed.net, or visit our website. Thank you so much for your dedication to diabetes. This is Beverly Tomasian signing off.